You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Hey everyone, Chris Lopez here. Welcome back to another podcast episode. So I have two guests in the studio today. The first one I'll introduce is Preston Newberry. Preston is a real estate agent here at Your Castle who does a lot of work with investors. So Preston, how are you?
I'm doing great, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
And so our second guest is Ian Kunchez, and he is a developer, a custom home builder, and general contractor here in Denver. So Ian, welcome.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Good. And so the way this podcast kind of came about is that Preston and Ian are actually working on a deal, and Preston was just, you know, we were grabbing coffee or catching up, and he's telling me about some offers putting in on a piece of land around Denver. And I was sort of saying, oh, well, what are you going to do with it? What are the numbers like? And it was actually for Ian talking about building a custom home on there. So it kind of opened up this really fun can of worms where just Ian, you got a very impressive background and you guys were both gracious enough to join us on the podcast. So Preston, I'll let you kind of set this up to kind of talk about this land first, and then we can kind of segue into your background, Ian. But just kind of when you guys are out there looking at land to do stuff, what's the process you guys look for?
I mean, right now, obviously, trying to find land in anywhere in Denver is pretty difficult. So whether it's, you know, something we find off market or something that's on the MLS, there's a lot of due diligence that goes along with that. So Ian and I are always out looking for any kind of deal we can find on land, trying to make the numbers work, seeing if it's something, you know, square footage wise and price point wise for the neighborhood that we could get a property built and make some money on it. So that's kind of the idea behind that whole process.
And Ian, what is your background? Like, how did you, I mean, you're wearing three big hats, developer, general contractor, custom home builder. Like, how'd you get into this?
My entire family is actually in real estate. So I grew up around it. My father and my uncle owned actually the largest masonry company in Colorado growing up. Built Walmarts, and they actually built part of Flatirons Mall, did the smaller buildings around the mall. They didn't actually build the mall, but they built
the strip mall.
Thank you. Okay. Great indoors, those kind of areas. And every day I would be wanting to go to work with my dad. So I was always in construction to some extent. My grandfather was in mortgage banking. My other uncle's in mortgage banking. So our entire family is in real estate somehow. We were just always around it. And I knew that that's what I wanted to do my whole life. I've always wanted to be a builder. So as soon as I had the opportunity and I was ready, I started the company. My dad and I are actually business partners. So we started this company together in 2011 and just been growing it since then. We actually got pretty lucky with when we started. Market was still pretty slow. We've just been growing with the real estate market.
And what's the name of your company?
Distinctive Development.
Distinctive Development. And when did you guys get started?
It's February 2011. Okay. It's when we actually opened this company. My dad's been in construction for 38 years now, but together we started in 2011.
And you started that with to build custom homes originally, or what was like the original focus of there?
To build custom homes.
Okay.
Primarily. We've always dabbled in some commercial work, and the commercial side has taken off a lot lately, but custom homes will always be our go-to.
Okay. And what's the process of going out there and building a custom home? Is it finding a vacant land, or like how do you even start that?
It's a heck of a process. Finding land is definitely the most difficult part of it, especially with the Denver real estate market right now. You can't find land, and Preston can add to that. There's nothing out there. And when you do find something, there are numerous offers and you have to be able to close quickly and really jump on it in order to get your hands on a piece of land that works. So finding the land is extremely difficult, and land prices have been escalating quickly, especially in the more desirable neighborhoods. You know, Wash Park, you're spending $600,000-$700,000, if not more, to buy a piece of land that needs to be torn down. And we built a lot in North Highlands, West Highlands, 5-6 years ago. And I think we probably snagged the last reasonably priced piece of dirt in that area at $275,000. And while we were under construction on that house, land just skyrocketed. And you're starting to see pieces of dirt going for $450,000-$500,000 that were either in need of full rehab or needed to be scraped for a new build.
And so what have the land prices done? I mean, you got started in 2011. We're in the fall of 2018 now. Just, I mean, if you can, I know it's a really hard question, but just like Highlands is a huge development area. Just like how much has that changed over there price-wise?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, for example, Highlands in 2011, 12, 13, you could find houses for $250,000 still. pretty consistently. And now to find a piece of dirt, when we were looking at it, $350 list price was unheard of. Everything is normally $450, $500, and that's...
And especially when you get into some of the bigger size lots, and that becomes a whole nother part of it, and we'll get into that a little bit later in the podcast as far as the square footage of the lot and what the city will allow you to build on the lot for coverage and all that kind of stuff. So again, that just kind of goes back to the due diligence side and knowing what you're looking at and what you're looking for and what you can build there and being prepared for that.
So let's go and jump into that, because I know that is... You know, there's, yeah, looking at the zoning, all those other things. So when you guys are out there evaluating a piece of land or have your search criteria, what's kind of the broad level checklist you start off with? You know, what are you looking for when you check out the zoning, when you check out this? Like, what's the checklist?
I mean, first and foremost, we have areas in town that we know that we're looking for stuff. So we've got searches and whatnot set up for those parts of town. And from there, you know, if anything pops up or we come across something that, you know, might even be off market, first thing we do, we start looking at square footage on the lot to know, you know, one, does it work for what we want to build? Ian's got a pretty good idea kind of off the cuff of his hand of what he wants to build and what's going to work in certain parts of town. So, you know, we look for square footage on the lot. From there, check the zoning and make sure that the zoning will allow kind of what we want to build square footage wise. And then it's just a matter of kind of jumping in and seeing what it's going to end up costing to get that lot, you know, how much competition there is and what we can do to make it happen.
When you're looking at, if something comes up in one of these neighborhoods you want, do you create plans from scratch or you just have like a general kind of in the back of your mind, okay, the lot's this size, this neighborhood, I would build something like this square footage. Like, how do you calculate that?
Denver's pretty fortunate. Their city planners were pretty consistent. So a 50 by 125 lot is a fairly standard size in Denver. You can find in numerous different neighborhoods. So that's kind of the baseline for us because that allows us to build pretty much anything we want. Anything smaller than that, you start getting into design criteria for architecture that minimizes what you can do with the house. You end up with a really narrow footprint, and you can still do really cool stuff with a narrow lot. It just is more difficult. So 50 by 125 allows you a wide enough lot to build a pretty average house that you see all over Denver, especially when you have alley access. Without alley access, things get more difficult. You need a wider lot because then you have that front-loading garage. But most of the time, a 50 by 125 is a pretty standard. And then we always take from that, we do scratch architectural plans.
What is scratch?
So we'll start from zip. It's the architect. We meet with him and we have a preliminary meeting and kind of put our ideas on the table and let the architect go with our design input and go from there. So he designs the houses from scratch. We don't reuse plans.
And that's one thing that Ian and Distinctive is really, really good about is making sure that the stuff they build is very unique. Ian is a big proponent of that. He doesn't want to build stuff just like everybody else in town. It's going to have unique characteristics and really be something different than what you'll find out there right now.
And so when you start the design process, I'm assuming you've already got the property under contract then, or do you start the design process before?
It's generally after. Okay. So it's after we've closed on the lot. Once we're under contract, you're pretty solid, but there's always the risk that the lot doesn't work out. We've been there. There's always the risk that the buyer finds or the seller finds a way out, or you find something in your due diligence that doesn't allow you to build on the lot or build what you want on the lot. So generally that design period starts once the lot is closed. Okay. And you actually own it.
And what's kind of like the basic due diligence? So you get a piece of land under contract. What's the, obviously you do an inspection, but there's probably way more to it than the general inspection you do on a home.
It's different and it depends on the neighborhood. If you're in Denver proper, due diligence is pretty straightforward. It's a matter of just checking the zoning and making sure that there aren't any odd easements on the property, anything that would affect development of the land. Outside of Denver, if you're getting into the more outlying suburbs, we're doing a big house in Parker right now, there's a lot more to it because you'll have oftentimes HOA and architectural guidelines that the HOA requires. And that would be part of our due diligence process is to review those design guidelines and make sure that we can build what we want in that neighborhood.
And so how come, because I mean, what I see most people doing this is they're, you know, buying properties in Highlands, knocking them over, putting up a duplex and selling them side by side. Sounds like you're going more of the custom home route. Is there a particular reason why?
To me, more fun. I've built duplexes and I don't really like building them. You can, and there's good money in them and they're fun, but I prefer personally to build higher end custom stuff. I like to go to the job site every day and see special features. And that's not something you generally get when you're just building your run-of-the-mill duplex and you're pumping them out as fast as possible.
And Preston, I mean, I'm trying to paint a picture here for our listeners out there. How would you describe custom homes, because that has got such a broad category, and you've seen them, you've seen a lot around Denver. How would you describe them?
On the custom home side of things, you know, there's quite a few different builders around town that are doing stuff, and it's really incredible to see what they put together and the ideas that they have and just some of the features and products that they put out there. I mean, obviously you end up spending a lot more money on the custom side, but they're able to get a lot more creative. They can build some really cool stuff and kind of let their imaginations run wild. And that's fun to go see, especially when you're out showing homes or involved in the process with builders and watching their stuff come out of the ground. You really get a special feel for the what they go through in the process and how they put things up.
And so is your typical process like you buy the land, you design it, you build it, then you sell it? You're not working with a client from day one?
Sometimes. A little bit of both. Generally, we'll prefer to build on our own as a spec and then sell the house when we get to a certain point, generally drywall. That allows somebody to come in and make a few minor changes. We've done a lot of full custom homes where you have a client, you find them a piece of dirt, you design the house with their input, and it's difficult. And then it adds a whole nother level of management to the process, and it slows the whole process down.
Is that just because you're working with people and they can't make up their mind, or exactly, they change mind, versus you were just like, make a decision, yeah, get it done?
Homeowners are great, but they can be emotional. They can't make up their mind. They don't want to spend the money. They want this tile for this amount of money, but it doesn't work like that.
And then they end up changing their mind halfway through, and they want, you know, to change a bunch of stuff and don't understand that that's going to end up costing a lot more money. And that, you know, is always something that is kind of unknown to a lot of clients as they go through that home building process, that, you know, changes cost money. So you got to make up your mind and move forward with it.
And so circling back around to when you buy the dirt and the finished product, like how much of the total cost of the finished house is the actual land? What percentage roughly?
We try to stay under 33%, a third. And that's a really basic rule of thumb that we've used, but 33% of your total construction cost should be land or less. It changes a little bit depending on the price point of the house, that your end price point. But as a general rule of thumb, 33% is pretty good.
Is that something that you came up with, or is that just one of those like industry norms that people follow?
You know, I don't know, actually. It's something that we've always just followed internally. I'm not sure that I've ever heard it from anyone else outside of our companies, but that's just something we've always used.
And when you do the numbers and you work everything and you see what, you know, price point you're looking at in a certain market or certain neighborhood, and you kind of back all those costs out, it usually ends up being pretty close to where you're going to end up as far as land costs to build costs. So,
and I mean, just to kind of give our listeners context, the custom home, the final price, I mean, they're usually in the 7-figure range, right? For a lot of this work
Absolutely.
You do? Yeah.
Absolutely.
So these are really nice custom homes.
Absolutely. We generally try not to build anything under a million. 1.2, 1.3 is probably our bottom and up from there.
Is that just kind of like basic economics with the land, or is that just because you sound like a very creative, passionate guy? Is that just, hey, if I'm in this price range, I get to like be a kid in the candy store exactly. And have fun?
You get to have a lot more fun with it. And again, I've built stuff in the $500,000 range, and there's money to be made there. But to me, it's just like you said, it's let's have fun with this. Yeah. And let's build some really cool, special stuff. And you don't really get to do that at 500.
Build a few really cool homes every year rather than a bunch of, you know, mediocre product every year. There's an avenue for everybody, and there's a lot of builders that do that. But I think with Ian's creativity and what they do at Distinctive, that really fits their mold and kind of what they're trying to do.
Yeah, that's actually really cool to hear you. I mean, not just that, but like you can hear the passion and voice and you light up when you talk about it. Like, you know, very few people or get that into the design process, more just the numbers, which is totally fine, but it's just you're on a different side of the coin and definitely in the minority of people out there building homes, which is really cool to see. So, I mean, just kind of a broader level question, not necessarily geared towards building custom homes, but, you know, we run into people all the time that want to get into real estate investing, that want to get into development or redevelopment properties. You know, I'll just say lower price point, generally speaking. What advice do you have for people out there that want to either do what you're doing or kind of play in the same ball field where they're doing some major development or redevelopment work?
Be patient. It takes a lot of time. People think that they can get into real estate and they have, you know, $100,000 they can invest and they can go easily turn that into $200,000, but it doesn't work that easily. A lot of people don't really understand that this process takes years. I mean, I've been at it for 7 years now, 7.5 years, And we're really just getting going over the last 3 or 4 years. It's slow and it takes a lot of headache to get there. That would be my biggest advice. Just be really patient with it. Make wise investments. Don't risk everything.
And people need to understand that these development projects and custom projects, I mean, they take a lot of time just to do the work, to the build out and all that. And I think, you know, a lot of people don't anticipate that it could be a 9 to 12 month build process after they've gone through everything they need to due diligence wise with the city, they've gotten all their permits. I mean, from the time they break ground, you're looking at, you know, anywhere from 8 to 12 months, depending on the product that you're building. And in Colorado, we have weather delays and all those kind of things that go along with it. So you got to be prepared for that.
So from your typical, like you close on a piece of dirt today to when you're handing the keys over to the homeowner, typically what's the time frame for doing that?
18 to 24 months.
Is a total turnaround time.
Construction time, like Preston said, can be anywhere from 7 to 12 months, depending on the project and the complexity. But there's a lot more to it. Design can take 3 months. The city permitting phase can take anywhere from 3 to 8 months. I've had it take 8 months, and it's difficult. So you add that all together, 24 months is a pretty solid time frame from closing to closing.
Now, you said earlier, like, you know, be patient and, you know, don't take huge risks. Can you quantify, like, hey, what's a huge risk? So if you got 100,000 play with, 200,000 play with, do you have like a certain ratio you use? Hey, we got this much capital and we'll float this, we'll do that. Like, how can someone evaluate that type of risk and, you know, where that is on the spectrum? I know it's a really hard question, but like I'm always intrigued by people that do work by you, because it's a totally different thing that way out of my wheelhouse. And I'm always interested how people can evaluate that risk, because in plus 24 months, that's a long time in real estate.
It's really just being smart about knowing the market is what I mean by risk. And it's not necessarily taking risk, the financial risk. I think by the time you know that you want to invest X amount of money, you understand that risk. But I mean, to be smart with what you're investing in and what you foresee and forecast that specific neighborhood to do. Because neighborhoods, especially in the Denver metro area, they change dramatically over just a 2 or 3 year period.
We've seen that. I mean, you know, just in those neighborhoods now, I mean, you go there and see what's coming out of the ground now versus what was there 3 years ago. And the products have changed and they've morphed and price points have all gone up. And so that really drives a lot of what you forecast and what you're looking for, knowing that it's going to be, you know, 2 years before you have a house built and out of the ground and keys to it.
Yeah. And it's really about being smart about what you're building in what neighborhood. So you can't build the same house in Eisenhower Park as you do in the Highlands. You need a very specific product in Eisenhower Park, for example. People want to see ranches. So we're building ranch homes with a finished basement over there. And you have a demographic in that neighborhood that's generally in the late 50s, early 60s. They either have kids in college or they're empty nesters. And they want to have that house that lives like a 2,000-foot house when their kids aren't home. But then when their kids come home, they have a basement and they don't feel like they're crowded.
Everybody has room to spread out. And
yep. Whereas the Highlands, you generally have a younger demographic that wants to be close to the city, but they want a house and they want all the features and they want as big of a house as you can build. So last couple of houses we built in the Highlands were maximized square footage, as big as we possibly can, rooftop deck, and then do some cool features inside. So we did elevators in both of those houses, for example.
Talk about some of the cool features that you've put in some of the properties you've done.
Elevators are always a big talking point. Everybody loves elevators. So we've done a couple elevators. They're actually surprisingly not as expensive as people would you generally think. You know, an elevator can cost 30-ish thousand, 30 to 40 grand.
Now, are these like 2-person elevators?
Yeah, they're small. You know, the 3x5, but it's an elevator in your house. It's still cool. Rooftop decks are a big one. Everybody wants to see rooftop decks. I've done glass floors.
Do you or do your clients actually end up putting like hot tubs on the rooftop deck? Because I've talked to a couple of developers where they're like, yeah, we used to build them out all the time, but then it's $10,000 for the hot tub, then it's $10,000 for the crane to drop them on there, exactly. And no one does it.
I haven't put a hot tub on a rooftop deck. I have a client that we built a house for 5 or 6 years ago that came to me and asked about putting a hot tub on his deck after the fact. And we had to remind him that we didn't design the house structurally to support a hot tub on the rooftop deck. So it's absolutely doable, but you have to keep in mind that you're adding several hundred or thousand pounds of weight up to a deck in a fairly small footprint that the house may not be designed to carry, or the structural may not be designed to carry. So, but yeah, so rooftop decks are a big one. The elevators are always a big one. Our staircase.
You guys do a lot of cool stuff with staircases.
Such a big feature. Everybody loves stairs. And it's always fun. That's one of those items in a house that you can really have a lot of fun with and do some cool design too, and build some cool stuff there. Stairs, stair railings. I did a glass floor in a house, so that was fun. So hallway down the second floor, you had a floor to ceiling windows on one side, and then the floor that you were walking on was glass down to the main floor. So that was pretty cool.
And this is just something that you and the designer just came up, hey, this would be cool to do this. Or
the client threw it out there. They're like, we'd like to do a glass floor. And so we did it. And it actually turned out really, really cool. And it's something that we'll probably do again at some point.
Now, how does that change? Like, because I know the normal floors and basic framing, but how does that just work? Like framing it in, and I guess do you even frame it? I don't know. What do you do with the glass?
For that specific one, I think the hallway was 9-ish feet long, 3 feet wide that the glass floor went in. And instead of framing that with TJIs, what we did was we used a glue lam to support, basically create a perimeter support for the glass.
What is a glue lam?
It's a structural, it's an engineered structural beam, basically. So we used a glue lam for the perimeter to support the glass, and then we had two supports in the center. So glass ended up being three pieces. So you'd have a 3x3 panel of glass, and then so you had three in a row. So 3x3 panel of glass, 3x3 panel of glass, and then a third one. It was actually a really cool feature. The clients realized after the fact that when they had parties, it might not be great for women wearing dresses, so they ended up frosting it, which took away from the aspect. But I get the mentality.
Well, I'm just curious, like, what does something like that just cost? Like, how much? Like, compare that to like a normal.
The actual cost was not that expensive, and I remember this was years ago. I remember grossly undercharging for it, strictly because it was very, very difficult and very time consuming. The glass was expensive.
Material probably wasn't a huge cost, but I think that, you know, the time and labor.
The design and figuring out the best way to do it and make it look good, that was heavily time consuming. So I remember, it's been so long. I'm trying to remember. I think it would probably be, to do a very similar thing, probably like a $10,000-ish jump now.
I thought it'd be a lot higher.
Yeah,
it
wasn't too bad. I mean, I think it was fairly reasonable, and obviously prices have come up since then, but that's probably a pretty good ballpark.
So I want to just kind of pivot here and actually about some specific deals. But before I do, like, you are 7 or 8 years in. You said you guys really picked up steam the last few years. So I'm sure you've had a lot of successes. I'm sure you've taken a few black eyes along the way as well. If you could go back in time and tell your 7-year younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
And it's funny. It's actually some advice that my dad gave me right when we started. He said, custom homes are a pain in the butt. And I told him, no, I want to do custom homes. They look fun. And I really want to work with clients and do that. And actually, he was spot on. And I should have listened. He did it before, but custom homes are tough. And working with clients can be extremely difficult. And that would probably be the one piece of advice going back, was just learn from previous experiences and deal with customs better.
What would you specifically have done different? Would you have not gone down the custom home route?
You know, it depends on the home and it depends on the client. I think for me, it's being more selective with clients. I was wide open years ago. I would take every client that came to me, and I'll take your job. I have a bad feeling about you. We don't get along well, whatever it is, but I'll do it anyway. And that definitely hurt a few times.
And knowing where to set the expectations and Absolutely. Be, you know, upfront with clients, especially because a lot of them don't know what they're getting into. And I think, you know, I've seen along the way some of those things come up, and it's one of those deals where if you would have, you know, kind of set the expectation up front and laid out the groundwork for them ahead of time, it probably would have been a little bit different, you know, no different than a lot of things we see in the residential side when dealing with clients. You're just dealing with somebody that's now building a custom home that they're going to live in for a long time, and they can get a little emotional about it.
Absolutely.
I can hear the undertones, a little emotional. I'm sure you've had some. I'm sure you had some fun conversations.
We have, but you also have good ones. So don't take it that it's all bad. But there's definitely good and bad. The good far outweighs the bad, absolutely, like tenfold. But the bad ones, they stick. You know, they stick.
So what's like the? I mean, like, I don't want to say worst deal, but what's been the deal with the best learning experience for you?
Which deal? Let's see. Two that come to mind, and they're really my only two bad deals. I won't name names, but we did a pop top in Wash Park that was very difficult. And renovations are always tough, strictly because you don't know what you're getting into. You can take a good guess based on the age of the home, and expected construction practices for when it was built. But until you really start opening up, you have no clue what you're getting into. So that one was difficult. And then one of the customs in Wash Park was also very difficult. And again, part of that was me, and I'll take the blame on that and how I handled it. It was, like Preston said, the expectations weren't set well from my side. So clients expect a certain thing based on conversation, which is not what I intended, but it's how they took it. So those two would be my biggest learning.
And a lot of that comes from just communication styles too, you know, being in the business and talking about certain things and knowing what expected procedures are and having a client that's never done this before and not quite understanding that. It's just, you learn as you go and you understand where you need to set those expectations and be really clear about certain things, even though you know that's how you're going to operate and that's what you're going to do. You got to make sure that the clients understand that up front.
And Preston touched on it earlier. You talked to a client about construction time, for example. And yeah, we can build this house in 6 or 7 to 12 months. But the client doesn't think about the time that it takes to get to the point of construction. You don't factor in the design phase and the permitting phase. And unfortunately, as much as we try to control it, we can't. And the city is extremely slow, especially Denver. And when you have a set of permits that takes 6 months to get approved, then there's really nothing you can do about that.
And that's been a big problem in Denver for many years now, is the permitting side, and why we've seen a lot less new building in Denver than what we need for the people that are here. It's been really difficult for the builders and contractors to get through the city with all the permitting, and it has backed things up, you know, 6, 8, 12 months in some cases for projects.
So, I mean, just if you guys could wave a magic wand and, you know, change the way the process works. I mean, it's a permitting process. It's just kind of the stereotypical red tape where it just kind of sits on desk for months and takes time.
Yeah, and Denver just doesn't have the staff to handle the quantity of permit applications they're getting. And they're getting better, and they're hiring, and they've...
Over the last 12 months, they've really stepped it up.
They have. They've revised. They've changed their software. They've changed their queue system for actually being at the billing department, and that's helped a little bit. But they're just understaffed, unfortunately. And that's what it boils down to, is they don't have enough people.
Really? So it's that simple of a thing, just not enough people to... And even with all the demand and people and money coming in, they just haven't ramped it up?
They have, and they're working on it, but it takes time. It does. And as they hire, it's slowly gotten better. I think permits are probably 3 to 4 months now, but they're still not as quick as they should be.
And we have to remember, I mean, our unemployment rate in this city is pretty low as it is. So trying to find qualified people that fit the niche and are able to take over positions in the building department right now, I think it's been difficult for them over the last 2 or 3 years. So it's just, you know, all these things have kind of added up and caused a big backlog in permitting right now.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. So Ian, I mean, you're a general contractor. I'm assuming you've probably got a construction crew or a couple that you work with a bunch of subcontractors. And for a lot of people who aren't doing anything at like the scale you're doing at, they're just, you know, doing a fix and flip or doing some minor work. Like, what advice can you share to help someone go out there and find some good subcontractors?
Subcontractors are tough. It's really just trust your gut on the interview process. Make sure you get numbers up front and make sure your subcontractor is willing to stand behind their bids. Make sure you actually subcontract them. A lot of subcontractors will have their estimate template and their contract version that they'll want you to sign. And I would suggest that you don't just sign that.
Say that again so that when they give you just...
So a lot of subcontractors will provide their estimate as an estimate proposal with a contract aspect to it. And by signing the proposal, you're also signing their contract terms.
So it's basically like a quote that they also put a signature line on rather than an actual contract. And so you see, you know, I'll let Ian explain more, but you see a lot of people kind of misconstrue that and not understand what they're signing.
Absolutely. So what we always do is we'll get subcontractor estimates for whatever piece of the work that they're going to be doing. And we'll actually, if we award them the project, we'll provide our subcontract template to them. We attach their estimate as an addendum, but that way we're controlling what that subcontract is for and what they can and can't do. And it helps us control job site practices and safety practices and cleanliness and all that kind of stuff.
So you're doing way more than just price and materials. You got a much bigger scope.
You have to. And our insurance dictates that we have certain clauses in there that protects us and them. And it allows us to hold the subcontractors accountable. So that would be my biggest thing is make sure you get a solid number. Make sure you execute a subcontract with that subcontractor.
And have a really clear scope of work as well, and have that before you even meet and interview with your subcontractors. Know what you want, know exactly what you want, do your research so that you are getting the same bid from everyone and know what you're getting.
And I mean, you've got your, this is one of my favorite questions to ask people. I mean, you grew up in real estate, you got your finger on the pulse. What does your crystal ball say about the Denver real estate market in the near future and the long term?
My opinion, I think Denver is going to slow down a little bit over the next year or two. I don't see a huge downfall or another crash like we had in 2008. I don't see that happening anytime soon, but I think it'll flatten out a little bit. It's been on a constant rise. So I see a little bit of a flat and then continue to rise at a more reasonable scale rather than this jump that we've had over the past few years.
So no longer double digit increases, more in the single digits.
I think that's more realistic. A more sustainable growth is what I see happening.
And in the, I know you do a lot of stuff, you know, in the $1+ million custom home range. I know that market is entirely different from, you know, the $500,000 and less. And if you look at the stats on MLS, it's a very, you know, much softer market. Have you seen that change as far as like selling a property or how long a property sits in the market for you to sell?
It depends. The $1 million stuff is still fast. It sells quickly, especially if you're smart about what you're building and where you're building it. Generally, it's under contract before we're finished. But you get into the higher end stuff, the $2, $3 million range, and that stays pretty flat consistently.
And you're starting to see that a little bit. You know, Wash Park is a really good example of that. There's a few homes over there that were on the market for 90 plus days in the, you know, $2.5+ million range. And obviously, you know, they kind of came on market in seasonal slow times and whatnot. But, you know, that's somewhat typical to see them sit on the market a little bit longer if they haven't been pre-sold from the builder.
And so you typically, a lot of times while you're building, do you start marketing it to get interest?
Yes.
Okay.
At a certain point, well, we actually get a surprisingly large amount of interest just from drive-bys. We're not in the MLS until later on in construction, but we'll get, gosh, on average, probably 5 to 10 calls minimum per project that are just, hey, I drove by the house you're building on XYZ Street. Interested if you're going to be selling it or interested if you have anything else. And that's a big one.
And did you just have like basically like your construction sign out front or like, and that's
our minimum. It has our logo on it and it has an emergency contact number, which we're required to have. And people call that number and they're like, hey, you selling this house? That's been a big driver of sales for the last few years.
Okay. So there is, I mean, there's a lot of demand up there doing that, huh?
There are. And that's really is a reason we're actually rebranding our residential side currently. And that's a big reason why is we want to create a specific brand for our residential side of construction and our homes and really start marketing that side of things. We want to increase and improve our site on-site marketing and really create a brand for our company rather than a name, right? So we're in process of doing that. And, you know, our job site signs, like I said, they're currently a banner with an emergency contact. We want to improve those and do a bigger sign with a rendering of the house and get trade partners on there and do all that kind of stuff as well. So,
and so this is kind of like we were talking before we hit record on the podcast here, that kind of be rebranding more for like the residential side and I don't want to say spinning off, but just separating the residential from some of the commercial stuff you do?
Correct. We do a lot of commercial work and would like to separate the two to some extent. The rebrand will be a subsidiary, a DBA of Distinctive. Distinctive will stay active, but Distinctive will focus on our commercial side, doing tenant improvements and new construction. And then the new company will be focused on our residential side.
Okay. Now I'm looking through here my list of questions. I think I got all the main questions I wanted to pick your guys' brain on. Any like topics or things you guys start talking about and I cut you off that you want to touch on before we wrap things up here?
So we closed on this land down at the Colorado Golf Club back in March, something we've been looking around at for quite a while, and finally we're able to hone in on a piece of land that was going to work for what they wanted to build. So,
and how'd you find this? This off-market, MLS?
It was in the MLS, but it was an area that we hadn't really been looking strongly at just because of the distance from town. But when we started looking into it and kind of, you know, really looking at the numbers and what was being built out there, and the Colorado Golf Club has a really interesting history, and I'll let Ian get into that a little bit. But, you know, when did they start that? Back in 2000?
Right before the market crash. Yeah, so it was 2007, I believe.
They started building the golf club?
Yeah, they started building the golf club. And it's a world-class golf facility that they have down there. The course is fantastic. And obviously they've got, you know, development housing around it. And the economy crashed and the golf club went through, you know, some ownership changes and stuff like that. And so they're kind of on the rebuilding phase now. And you're seeing a lot of younger families moving down there. You're seeing, you know, really cool new custom homes being built. So we were looking around and we're kind of like, hey, this might be an option. So went down, checked it out, ended up closing on the property in March. And from there, you know, it's been all HOA and meetings and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, Ian has been lucky enough to let me be a part of some of that and just kind of see how that process goes. And it's been really interesting seeing all the hoops that you have to jump through and just what the process is like. And it's given me a big respect for what they do and knowing how much due diligence there is and how much work goes into everything before you even break ground on building the house.
And I know HOAs can be super strict, super lax. Is this kind of like a middle of the road HOA?
Oh, they're difficult. They have a very stringent architectural guideline that they follow to the T.
And we've pushed the boundaries with them a little bit.
Like when you say strict, I mean, is that just color, size?
Everything. It's everything. I mean, there's a 3,200 square foot minimum square footage above grade. And exterior colors are XYZ. And you have a little bit of room to work in there, but not a lot. And it's very defined in the architectural guidelines. And it's good. I mean, it is good what they do. They require that you actually design an architecturally appealing house. You're not just building a box, which is good for the neighborhood as a whole. They want to see varying roof lines, and they want to see that you're actually really thinking about the design of the house, not just the function of it. I think it is difficult. As difficult as it was to go through, I think it's very beneficial.
And I think Ian learned some things. I definitely learned some stuff, you know, watching this process go through. And
like, what was your biggest takeaway, Preston?
I think the biggest takeaway for me was the time aspect of it. You know, when we closed in March, both of us kind of thought like, hey, by end of summer, you know, we'll be breaking ground. This project will be moving along. And it's taken a good 90 days more than I think either of us thought it would have. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just kind of an eye-opening thing. And it goes back to setting those expectations with clients and, you know, making sure that everyone understands that there's a lot of stuff that's out of your control, but you still have to go through the steps to make it all happen. So you have to be prepared for that.
And just give people context, they said they closed in March. We're recording this the first week of October. Yep. So everyone just knows the timeline since this is recording. So have you guys broken ground yet?
No, not yet. We got a HOA approval last Wednesday, full HOA approval. So basically in that HOA, at least, you close on the lot, you design the property, your concept design at least. And then you have a preliminary meeting with the HOA committee, which unfortunately they only meet once a month. So that slows the whole process down. So fourth Wednesday of the month, you meet with them. So you have an on-site preliminary meeting with the HOA design review committee. And then you have essentially a month to prepare your conceptual submittal. So your first submittal to them.
Which is all of the architectural drawings and the landscape drawings and all this stuff.
For them, you have to provide a conceptual architectural plans, conceptual landscape plans.
Now, is 4 weeks, is that a short time?
That's short. Okay. It's tough. Okay. And not so much from meeting one to meeting two, but from the conceptual meeting to the final submittal, you have to then provide construction documents. You have to have fully finished architectural plans. You have to have structural plans. You have to have your landscape plans finished. And we're not talking a simple landscape plan that's a site plan of the house.
These are multi-page construction drawings.
There's planting plans and irrigation plans and all this.
They get that detailed, huh? Wow.
And it wouldn't be so, I mean, and not that it's difficult, but it wouldn't be as taxing, but being that this HOA only meets once a month, you have to get everything done by those monthly deadlines. It's not like you can just be like, okay, I'm ready now. You know, when are you guys meeting this week? It's like, if you want to move your process along, you have to be there every month with.
Because if you miss it, you're kicked out to the next month.
So for example, we did our preliminary site walk with the committee, I think in May. And then we had our conceptual plan meeting or conceptual submittal in June, the fourth Wednesday of June. They wanted to see some changes based on that plan. So we had to do a resubmittal on the conceptual, so July. And then at that meeting, we got approval to go to final submittal, which actually took us 2 months to prepare those documents. Probably could have done it in one, but we got down to the wire and we were like, we're not in a huge rush on this one. Let's not rush it. Let's get it done right. So we actually skipped one meeting and we submitted for the September meeting here just last month and got our final approval then.
And that's just approval from the HOA. Now starts the permitting process. Yes.
So once you actually have that HOA approval, they give you a letter that says the HOA review has reviewed these plans and we approve them architecturally. So then you take that letter and you go to, in this case, unincorporated Douglas County and submit for your building permits, which could take anywhere from 4 to 8 weeks.
Which is short in Colorado terms. Like Ian said, Denver could be months and months.
Yeah. Douglas County, I haven't worked with Douglas County in a long time. We haven't submitted for permits on this house yet. So we'll find out. I've heard mixed reviews. So like anything, you know, it's some people say they're difficult and some people don't. I tend to get along with people, so I don't think it'll be too bad.
So after you hear back, you get the permits from Douglas County, what's the next step? Then you can break ground.
Then it's full go. So in the meantime, we're doing some pre-construction stuff or some pre-construction activities. So we'll have the electrician go out and set a temp power pole, and we'll put the erosion control systems in, and we'll put our VCT in our vehicle control tracking, so make sure we don't track mud into the streets. And we'll get all that stuff ready so that once we actually have permits, we can start digging a hole.
Just press the go button and everybody's active.
Now, I mean, so you know, what sounds like maybe December, January, the time frame you guys are breaking ground, since that is getting to winter time, does that change anything for you as far as digging out foundations?
It slows it down a little bit. Not necessarily. I mean, you're not going to pour the foundation when it's snowing. You can pour a foundation all the way through winter. You're just not going to have guys out there working in a blizzard. So they could throw you off a week, but generally it's not a huge delay. It's just the consistency of the weather. So if you have a snowstorm this week and then it melts a little bit and then another snowstorm in 5 days and then another one 5 days later, that's when you start stacking up delays because
it never dries out. You never have enough time to catch up.
Okay, cool. So Ian, how can people find out more about your company? What's the best way they can see your projects and learn about your company?
Yeah, best way would be to visit our website. It's www.distinctivedevelopment.net. We have a portfolio on there. There's a contact page. You can go through and see some of the work we've done. And then if you're interested in anything, you can shoot us an inquiry via our contact page.
And I always like to throw this out there since, I mean, you guys are doing some unique stuff with finding land. I mean, we have a lot of people out there that are investors. We have wholesalers, people that, you know, run across properties. What's the type of land properties that you guys are looking for? Because you never know.
We're pretty open. I mean, it's really just a neighborhood basis. Most neighborhoods in Denver where we can find the comps that meet what we want to build, we'll look at.
So if somebody's got something out there, feel free to send it our way.
Cool. All right, gentlemen. Well, thank you so much.